This is Focus 580, hour number two of the program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. In this hour of Focus 580, we will be talking about the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. And our guest is Rachel Bronson. She is a senior fellow and director of Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. And she is the author of a book that looks at this relationship. The book was published last May, and the title is Thicker Than Oil, America's Uneasy Partnership with Saudi Arabia. It's published by the Oxford University Press, in which she writes this. She writes, "Few relationships are as vital, under as much pressure, and as poorly understood as that between the United States and the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia." And she goes on to argue, despite what people think, the common conception that there really is just one thing that this relationship revolves around, and that is oil. She says it's actually much more complicated than that. And certainly one of the things that has shaped this relationship and perhaps also shaped the political dynamic of the Middle East was the Cold War, something on which the United States and the Saudis had a lot of common ground. So we'll talk about these things here in this hour of Focus. And of course, people who are listening are welcome to call in and ask questions. The only thing we ask of callers is the callers are brief. We ask that so that we can keep our program moving and get in as many people as would like to join us. But of course, comments, questions, they're welcome. Here in Champaign, Urbana, the number to call is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so if it would be a long-distance call, if you're listening around Illinois or Indiana, or if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 for Champaign, Urbana, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Bronson, hello.
Hi.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
We appreciate it. You know, I came across a piece and something that you wrote, an opinion piece you wrote for the Washington Post that came out, I think must have been right around the time that the book came out. It was last May.
Mm-hmm.
That lists some common myths about the relationship between the two countries. And I thought, well, this actually offers us some great bullet points to. You could do worse than just talk about these five things. So maybe I would do that. At least we can talk about some of these things up front and perhaps get into greater depth. And I suppose the place to start really is, as I say, is with this idea that I'm sure a lot of people have, is that the relationship between the two countries is really only about one thing. It's about oil and what the two countries want. Each of their interests, the interest of the United States is oil. We need to have a reliable supply, and the Saudis are willing to supply it. But what they're interested in on their side is the Saudi rulers maintaining their position in their country and then in their region. So it's that kind of a trade-off. It makes it sound very simple and straightforward. And I think one of the things that you argue in the book is that, no, it's not quite that simple and straightforward.
That's right. And first, let me start by saying, because I think it's probably of interest to those listening, is that I've since changed positions from my New York position, and I'm now the Vice President for Programs and Studies here in Chicago at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
Oh, okay.
And so I want to make sure that folks know it's a hometown call.
Okay.
And I've just started in the last few days, but I'm delighted to be here as I look over Lake Michigan, as we speak. So absolutely, there's the common assumption, the conventional wisdom, if you will, is that the U.S.-Saudi partnership is nothing more, nothing less than a basic bargain of oil for security. Saudi Arabia provides us oil, and in response, the United States provides Saudi Arabia security. That means we give Saudi Arabia access to our defense industry. They can come in and buy a lot of stuff, and we also sort of provide a security umbrella over Saudi Arabia. Some would argue that extends to the House of Saud as well, but certainly over the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, and every president since Truman in 1950 has committed to the territorial integrity of Saudi Arabia. And that's sort of the understanding. It's worth noting that Saudi Arabia is not the leading supplier to the United States. We actually get most of our oil from close by, from Mexico, Canada, Venezuela. Regionally, Saudi Arabia is usually around fourth, but that's saying it's still a major oil supplier. What makes Saudi Arabia so important isn't just how much oil it has, the one quarter of the world's proven resources are in Saudi Arabia, but traditionally it never pumps to capacity, which means it always has extra capacity so they can always put more onto the market to reduce prices or stabilize prices. So an example of this would be if there's hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico, if something shuts down U.S. facilities, if there's political instability in Nigeria or in Venezuela, then Saudis can put extra money, extra oil onto the market. And basically those things all happened in 2003. You had hurricanes in the Gulf of Mexico, you had political instability in Venezuela and in Nigeria, and the Saudis started putting a million barrels of oil per day onto the market to stabilize prices right before the Iraq War in 2003. So this is sort of the importance of Saudi Arabia isn't so much, first of all, that it has so much oil, but also being a state-owned company, Aramco, a Saudi Aramco, that they're able to produce at less capacity and have this extra wiggle room. It's sort of considered the central banker of oil, if you will. So that's sort of the notion. It's just all about oil. But if you stop and think about America's partnerships with other oil producers, you start to realize that having a lot of oil doesn't equal good relations with the United States. What do I mean by that? Second largest country with oil, Iraq. Between 1967 and 2003, there were only 6 years where the U.S. had official relations with Iraq. Iran, country with about 10% of the world's oil, under sanctions since 1979. Libya, until very recently, terrible relations with the U.S. Venezuela, I mean, only in the last few years, President Bush was supportive of extra legal efforts to get rid of Chavez, president in Venezuela. We have often considered sanctioning Sudan's oil exports because of egregious human rights violations there. So having a lot of oil, in fact, does not lead you to good relations with the United States. Our partnership with Saudi Arabia has made it easier for others to sanction others. Our partnership with Saudi Arabia has made them more powerful. But it still begs the question, why are our relations so terrible with these major oil producers that I mentioned and good with Saudi Arabia? And that gets you to, I think, the more interesting discussion about shared political interests that the United States and Saudi Arabia have had over the last many decades. Mm-hmm. Certainly during the Cold War, fell apart after the Cold War and September 11th, I would argue that the interests are jibing a lot more now for reasons of counterterrorism and things like that. But why I got into the discussion of the Cold War, which I look forward to talking with you about, is that for the whole period, we had a shared interest with the Saudis, and that was bringing down godless communism. The Saudis were very worried about the expanding Soviet presence. We in Africa and the Middle East, we were worried. The Saudis were worried existentially about the godlessness and the message of that. We were, and so in this division of labor, they went after godlessness, we went after communism, and in many parts of the world, we partnered together.
And how far back does that, now here, this relationship that we're talking about, close relationship, really having to do with both sets of concerns, not just energy, that's one, but this other one too. This relationship we're talking about really goes back right to right at the end of World War II. So this is really not really a recent thing. This is something that spans the entire post-war period, which also is the Cold War period.
Right, exactly. I mean, you can go back. Saudi Arabia basically became the modern-day Kingdom of Saudi Arabia in 1932, and almost immediately oil was discovered there, and that's what brought the initial Americans there. But why Saudi Arabia starts becoming very interesting to American leaders, President Roosevelt, for instance, is geographically where it sits so important. So right at the end of World War II, there was the need to get American troops to the Pacific, the fighting in the Pacific. And the way we were going to do that was staging them through Saudi Arabia, using some of that airspace, using some of the, you know, we didn't have the kind of air travel we have now. So the air base in eastern Saudi Arabia was going to become very important to getting troops out into the Pacific. When the fighting in the Pacific stopped, we had these agreements for the air base that had been negotiated and no reason to do so. But there was the notion that this was going to be an important hub for air transport. Oil was there, and it was also a good place for the United States to be. And especially then in 1947, when it became clear that the Soviets might have an agenda that we didn't support. Remember, the Soviets were in Iran. They weren't leaving Iran. We were very nervous of them early on. And from the very beginning, in the late 40s, there was this notion that in addition to the oil, you know, oil is always important, of course, but as a place to begin to build a string of bases to push back the Soviets, Saudi Arabia had a lot of potential. So in the very early days, as far back as Roosevelt and then certainly Truman, this is the issue. What becomes fascinating is the Eisenhower period in the 1950s, because what Eisenhower, for a whole bunch of different reasons, he really doesn't like the British, he really doesn't like the French, he doesn't like the colonialism, and he really doesn't like, he's really worried about the Soviets. And he begins thinking about how Saudi Arabia as a country or a leadership that relies on religion can be used to fight the communists. And so he begins, and through his Secretary of State, John Foster Dulles, they begin talking about the king at the time, King Saud, the second king of Saudi Arabia, as a quote-unquote an Islamic pope. Maybe we can get him to serve an Islamic pope and rally the Muslim world against godless communism. And you see him beginning, the administration beginning to use those terms and thinking about whether Saudi Arabia can counter Gamal Abdel Nasser in Egypt, and also who's being backed by the Soviets, and also the Soviets more directly. And the notion of religion and how religion might play into this ideological global battle that Eisenhower sees, it's first introduced and becomes increasingly important over the decades.
Hmm. Well, then that's really fascinating, because it suggests that this concern that we have now heard about, that the problems we have now with militant Islam have to do with the Cold War battle between the United States and the Soviet Union, but that there's something that really only developed within the last couple of decades. We can trace it back to the invasion of Afghanistan by Russia. And our support for Islamic militants who were fighting the Russians, and here this was yet another proxy battle of the Cold War. What's fascinating is here is you're arguing that this kind of way of thinking that we could, in a sense, use militant Islamic fighters as a way of battling Soviet expansionism, it goes back some way further back, much earlier than the 1980s, in fact, all the way to the beginnings of the Cold War.
It does. And Afghanistan is, as you rightly point out, sort of the case now that everybody knows and points to. And Afghanistan is the most dramatic example where we really partner with the Saudis and the Pakistanis and getting sort of monies and logistics and troops up into Afghanistan and relying on Islamic militants to fight the Soviets directly, and it's the best case, it's the best known case, and so it's useful. But it's not the only one, and in fact, Afghanistan's dot Africa and the examples Pakistan and beyond. So let me give you an example. Sudan. Sudan is very much in the news these days. Well, Sudan during the Cold War was viewed as strategically vital. Why? Because it sat right between Libya, which was viewed as a Soviet puppet, if you will, Gaddafi, not a puppet, but an agent, and Ethiopia. So it was this very important place where the United States had a lot of concern with it. Well, as we're watching it, the Saudis are watching it too. This is very much their backyard. It's just right across the Red Sea, right in their backyard. And a lot of money, Saudi money, is going in 75, 76 into Sudan. It was viewed as potentially the breadbasket for the Middle East. A lot of money is also going into mosques. A lot of money is going to teachers and things like that. Where Saudi money went for strategic interests, also this proselytizing followed, a very austere, xenophobic, rigid interpretation of Islam, and especially after 1979. But what you have in the Sudan is Saudi Arabia has a lot of money. It's after the oil boom, right? It's after 1973. So a lot of Sudanese are going to Saudi Arabia to work, and then they go home. And the conduit for going to Saudi Arabia and coming home is the Muslim Brotherhood. So if you want to go work in Saudi Arabia and make a lot of money, the Muslim Brotherhood, which has come down from Egypt, is the broker. You pay the money, you go, you work, you make money, you come back, you give money back too. They start, the Faisal Islamic Bank starts up in Sudan, which becomes, which ends up funding a lot of sort of the religious and somewhat militant groups that start emerging. A lot of other institutions backed by Saudi money. So what ends up happening in the Sudan by the late 70s, early 80s, the Islamic parts are so much stronger in the Sudan than they would have been otherwise, that they basically go on to then take over power. And with through a guy named Tarabi and forward. And so it wasn't just Saudi money, but it was this investment in this Cold War battle zone that the United States and Saudi Arabia were very interested in. We're just fighting it very differently. And now you end up with these problems of the Islamic militants in Sudan and a real altering of their domestic politics. So it's an example of Sudan. Just to add to the one in Afghanistan, this kind of involvement, which is always for Cold War purposes and has an Islamic component to it, bring the United States and Saudi Arabia together. They bring them together in places like Pakistan, in places like Somalia, in places like Sudan. So throughout sort of this belt in Africa, the Saudis were very instrumental in turning back a Marxist coup in Zaire. I mean, it really is quite fascinating, and you can actually trace this into Asia. I spent more time focusing in my book on Africa, but in Asia as well. And so it's nothing, it's not just the last 15, 20 years. It really goes back to fighting the Cold War and the different things, if you will, that we brought to bear in that fight. And in case there's always some skepticism about this, but rolling forward to Afghanistan, there's this fascinating quote from Zbigniew Brzezinski, National Security Advisor for Carter, to show that this is not just Reagan, some people think, of the 80s, but it's Carter as well. It's both parties. It's a bipartisan policy in some ways, who says, they ask him about, you know, Afghanistan and the funding and everything. And he said, look, what was more important, the fall of the Taliban or the fall of the Soviet Union? A few stirred up Muslims or securing Central Europe? You know, it was really sort of viewed as this was an existential threat against the Soviets, and we were going to throw everything we had at it. And if it was using Islamic fighters, if it was getting money in and followed by proselytizing, that was okay because we had a bigger problem to fight.
Hmm. Let me introduce again our guest for anybody who might just recently have tuned in. We were talking with Rachel Bronson. She is now the Vice President for Programs and Studies at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, and that position she's just taken up here this month. Previously, she was Senior Fellow and Director of Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And she is the author of a book that takes a look at the relationship between the United States and Saudi Arabia. Her book is titled Thicker Than Oil. It is published by the Oxford University Press, came out last May. I'm sure that you can find it in the bookstore or the library if you want to read it. Questions are welcome here on the program. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here, and we'll start out with this person here, Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Thank you. Hello?
Yes, go ahead.
Okay. Your argument earlier is what I was initially responding to. I take your point that the relationship is more complicated. We live in a world where, you know, it's apparently not allowed to say that oil was fundamental in the attack on Iraq. So it gets in commonplace talk. It's referred to a lot, but it's dismissed as well at other times. And arguing that because we don't have good relations with other oil producers doesn't mean that oil is not fundamental. I don't know that's a logical fallacy whose name I don't know. But I'm willing to accept your arguments, but I just don't think that's one of your strongest ones. The fact that it's so fundamental that we will do things like engineer coups in countries makes it important that it's an important issue. We have a very compliant regime in Saudi Arabia to some extent, even though at the same time they were funding like the Contras in Nicaragua or the UNITA in Coca-Cola in the 80s, they were also funding, you know, the nuclear program in Pakistan. So I don't know if that was a quid pro quo or what. So there are a lot of complexities that don't get discussed, and I think it's admirable that you're talking about them. But the fact that oil is power and that much largesse of money and power allows the U.S. to sort of, in a kickback arrangement, get the Saudis to intervene in places where you wouldn't think they would have a real interest, unless you're going to just say, well, they're going after the godless communists, which is the ruse that I believe was used to allow us to have a war on the South. But that's another argument that doesn't get made real frequently. But I would like to hear what you have to say about some of that.
Sure, absolutely. Thanks for the question. I certainly don't want to leave the take-home message that oil isn't important. The book is called, I spent a lot of time thinking about this title. It's called Thicker Than Oil. So, you have to understand oil. But oil puts Saudi Arabia on the map to some extent. It's a very important, and oil colors every relationship that the Saudis have. 90 to 95% of their export earnings comes from oil. So, of course, it's very important. The point that I was making on other countries is that there is this sense that, you know, if you have oil, then you'll have good relations with the United States. Look at Saudi Arabia. And the only point is that we have lots of terrible relations with oil producers, and so there's something else that matters as well, and that's politics. So I don't want to leave with the sense that oil isn't important, but if you want to understand the U.S.-Saudi relationship, just focusing only on oil doesn't get you very far. The other thing that Saudi Arabia has, and we often forget about this, but it should not be forgotten, is it has Mecca and Medina, right? It has the center of gravity for the Islamic world. And there are many Muslims across the world who are not happy with the fact that so much attention that Saudi Arabia does wield such religious power because of Mecca Medina being there, but it is a fact. And that is another, there's oil that Saudi Arabia has, and there's Mecca and Medina. And I would argue that even without oil, it's a very strong argument, but even without oil, Saudi Arabia would still be important because of the role it can play. And the fact that it has oil makes it even more powerful. But so what do I mean by that? I mean, if you look at how the Middle East plays out, we've had good relations with non-oil producing states, Jordan, Israel, Egypt, and others. But throughout the years, Mecca and Medina has been very important. It's been very important in fighting godless communists. It's also been very important recently. It's one of the things that I argue why we have to be thoughtful and careful about our relations with Saudi Arabia, because if the United States and Saudi Arabia really end up on opposite sides of the ideological divide, they really end up, that's when I believe you do get a clash of civilizations. Some may argue we're already there. I wouldn't. But if Saudi Arabia sort of used its power and its pulpit for the Islamic world and really stood up face-to-face against the United States, I think we'd have an enormous security problem. So they have powers and equities that they can bring, and we do as well. But I think we need to be mindful of the power that it wields because of that, but also look at how Mecca and Medina has factored into and their own foreign policy. The caller brought up this very interesting, he used an important word. He said they've been very compliant, the Saudi government. Saudi government has gotten involved in funding the Contras, for instance. They put $32 million into the Contras. It was part of Iran-Contra, the scandal that broke. They had funded around the world. They were compliant. They were doing America's bidding, if you will. Or when I was doing my interviewing in Saudi Arabia, you would hear, we did America's dirty work. And to that, I would say, not true. Wasn't that they were compliant. It was that the leadership defined their national interests very similarly to the United States in terms of being worried about Soviet encirclement. Now, they weren't necessarily worried wholly that Soviets were going to come and invade their country, although when they invaded Afghanistan, they started to get worried about that. But they were worried that the Soviets were backing regional adversaries like Nasser in Egypt, like Gaddafi in Libya, that they were trying to make headway in Afghanistan. And so they chose to fight them. And they would do it independent of the United States, even if the United States wasn't involved. So the best example, again, going back to Africa, is in the 70s, the United States did not want to get involved in beating back Soviet expansion in Africa. The Americans were tired. We were exhausted from Vietnam. We didn't trust the CIA. We didn't want to put money into foreign operations, and so really constrained the Ford administration and its ability in Africa, for good or for ill. The Saudis, realizing that America was not a formidable actor in Africa in the 70s, hooked up with the French and the Moroccans and independently formed something called that they called the Safari Club, which was organized. Iran participated as well, organized to provide troops from the Moroccans and the Egyptians, money from the Saudis, and intelligence and logistics from the French to beat back leftist coups and governments in Africa, even when the United States can participate. So they had an agenda and interest. Their third king, King Faisal, was an ardent anti-communist. Ardent anti-communist, you can see it in his talk. It wasn't that they were compliant. It was that they defined their interests. And I think similarly to the United States, and I think especially because we're so engaged with the Middle East now, it's important to keep in mind that these countries have their own interests as well, and that they're trying to secure certain gains. And we have to understand what those are and define what our interests are and whether they mesh or not. But just to say that they're compliant, doing our bidding, our dirty work, I think misses a lot of what was driving their foreign policy in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and it would probably miss a lot of what's going on today, which I'm happy to talk about as well.
Well, we're already at our midpoint, and I have two other callers. I hope the caller won't mind if I go on. And I do also want to introduce again our guest, Rachel Bronson. She's the Vice President for Programs and Studies at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Just recently has taken up that position. Before that, she was Senior Fellow and Director of Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. Before that, she's been Senior Fellow for International Security Affairs at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, fellow at Harvard University's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs, and also adjunct professor at Columbia University, where she went to school. She got a PhD there in political science. And she is the author of the book Thicker Than Oil, America's Uneasy Partnership with Saudi Arabia, published by the Oxford University Press. The book was published last May. So if you're interested, you can go out and find the book. Questions are welcome to 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And we have some others. A couple of our folks here in Champaign will go next to line number two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering if during part of your research that if you ever interviewed John Perkins or at least read his book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman.
Yes, I did.
And, I'd like to, hear what's your take on what he had to say about his involvement in dealing with economic relations between the Saudis and the United States.
Yeah, I think that follows on to the similar kind of question from the last caller, which is, much of his involvement was on sort of making trade-offs for oil production and what the Saudis would do for oil and the sort of, what the United States wanted. My argument how I would round out his picture is that there's always a political context that you can't understand what these actors are doing unless you understand the political context that they're operating in. That, the reason you go out and make the certain deals that you do is always with certain political goals and aims in mind, and it's crucial that we understand what those are. Again, I'm going to come back to Thomas Friedman is probably the sort of best example of that. Over and over and over, he points out in his column, or he states, all we care about was Saudi Arabia. All we cared about was that the pumps were open and the gas was cheap. And he uses that expression repeatedly. Well, it's not all we cared about, and it's not all we care about now. So sort of to bring us up to the present a little bit, where many of your listeners, probably most familiar, is, so what are our interests with Saudi Arabia now? We have the sense of this conspiracy, House of Bush, House of Saud, that the reason that we have somewhat comfortable relations with Saudi Arabia is because of this long-standing relationship with the families, and if someone else was in power, you wouldn't have that kind of relationship. Well, first of all, not true, because if you look at Democrats or Republicans since Truman, you've had incredibly good relations. Kennedy was the exception, but even by the end of Kennedy, you had him going out and trying to woo the Saudis because he was so worried about what Egypt was up to. But if you look at when the state of relationships after 2000, at 2000, relations between the Saudis and the Americans were actually quite terrible. The Cold War was over. The Desert Storm was 10 years behind us. There was little engagement. President Bush didn't want to be involved in the Middle East, certainly not peace process issues. Fighting between the Israelis and Palestinians was high. Crown Prince Abdullah, at the time, now he's king, was very concerned about the fighting, didn't like the fact that the Bush administration was not getting involved. And he wrote a letter that Bandar, the long-serving ambassador now back in Riyadh, that Bandar delivered to the president saying, maybe it's time for a divorce. The relations are so bad, maybe it's time for us to go our separate ways. The president got nervous about that. That's any long-standing partner who presents that kind of ultimatum, nerve-wracking. So they called Prince Bandar in for a meeting. Said, you know, sir, let's talk about this. And they set that meeting up for September 13th, 2001. So 2 days after the worst attack on American soil. They had that meeting, but the meeting was very different. The importance of that shows that relations were terrible with the Bush administration. Then you have 2001, and they stay pretty terrible up through 2003. But this gets back to that question of what's the political agenda. In 2003, the Saudis finally turned their attention to their own domestic terrorism problem and started cracking down very, very hard once terrorism attacks started targeting the kingdom. Once the leadership made that decision and they started partnering with the United States, bringing the FBI into Saudi Arabia to work shoulder to shoulder with them in the kingdom, going after radicals at home, rounding them up and all that stuff, that's when you saw the Bush administration change their tune on Saudi Arabia and begin working with them more carefully. That change wasn't explained by oil. It was very much exchanged by the Bush administration putting counterterrorism as the primary concern, whether you agree with it or not. That was their decision to do that. And after that, switch on the Saudis, they started working. So that was a long answer, and I haven't forgotten the question, but the question is about sort of folks that go out and negotiate trade-offs and swaps for economics and oil, all very important, but there's always a political context. And unless we understand the political context, you can't understand those economic bargains.
Well, to be fair to John Perkins, I think he would argue that what it's really all about is maintaining U.S. economic dominance in the world, and the oil and these deals are ways of doing that and ways of keeping countries beholden to U.S. corporate and U.S. political interests, which are largely there to serve the economic interests. And I think that is more the gist of his argument.
Right. I would just flip it. I think for him it is that the political interests serve economic interests. And from my research and what I see, the way the Saudi relationship plays out as well, is that the economic interests and all that are important. They're usually serving political interests. And unless you understand the political interests, you can't understand the economic bargain. So that's just where he and I would disagree in terms of and he thinks his research bears it out. I obviously think mine does. But it's not sort of poo-pooing what he's done. It's just I don't think you can understand why he was sent to do the things he did unless you understand what the political interests of the leadership were at the time.
Well, again, I want to thank the caller for the comments. Let's go to somebody else. This is also a Champagne person in line 3. Hello.
Hello, and good afternoon or morning. And it's nice to hear a fresh view on what it's different than the knee-jerk reaction that we usually have about oil. The insights that I'm getting from the program, let me thank you and your guest. My question here is, Ms. Bronson, you work for whom in Chicago now?
I'm at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
Oh, okay. Chicago, and
it's just had a name change. So it was the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations, but in September they changed it to Chicago Council on Global Affairs.
And then prior to that, it was the Council on Foreign Relations, which is in New York.
No, you know, that's why they changed the name. One of the reasons is Council on Foreign Relations are all over the world. There's a German Council on Foreign Relations. They're all independent, but it just gets too confusing since the New York one is so well known. So they were entirely separate organizations. But yes, before I was here in Chicago, I was at the New York Council on Foreign Relations, just to add to the confusion.
Okay. Now, we have all kinds of guests coming in, people from the government, from universities, and just authors. I can't picture who you work for. That is, I'm going to be, I won't, instead of being sneaky, is there any Saudi money that floats around supporting these various kinds of
No. If you so the New York Council on Foreign Relations, where I sort of wrote this, where I was serving, where I wrote this book, is one of the United States' longest, oldest foreign policy establishments. The others are, I think, Carnegie Endowment in Washington, and actually the Chicago Council here. So it's longstanding. It's a membership organization. Doesn't get its money from governments, and it has never been tagged with, you know, receiving the Saudi money as some of the other sort of think tanks have been. So it's not one of those. It's not working for the Saudis.
Is there an endowment involved from a foundation?
I think David Rockefeller started the endowment, so there's probably some oil, an oil start to it. But
well, thank you very much. I was just curious because we. There's so many names out nowadays, this foundation and...
You know, let me just, though, pick up on this, because I think it's really important. I think it's why it's really difficult to talk about this issue, because you immediately get into sort of issues of funding and who's funding this and that. And let me just sort of throw this out there for what it's worth, and especially because my organization has never been tagged with you know, sort of Saudi funding, as others do. But the American political process is a very open process, and a lot of foreign money does come in, and it is part of our debate. Again, fortunately, unfortunately, you know, the German Marshall Fund puts a lot of money into an institution in Washington that goes on to support a lot of programs, lots of different governments, you know, the Thai government, the Taiwanese government, excuse me, there's a Japanese foundation and all of that. So this money is very much out there. But I think what's you know, important to this is why probably colleagues smarter than I chose not to focus on the Saudis is because as soon as you do it, you either have to be very vitriolic to prove you're not accepting Saudi money or you're tagged with receiving Saudi money. And it's, you know, and who sort of, I guess, you know, for professionally, who wants to be associated with that? But I didn't receive any Saudi money. I wrote this book because I think that this is one of the most important partnerships that the United States has. It's longstanding. Unless we really understand our relationship to it, we cannot understand sort of our sort of position in the world and certainly our position in the region. Folks in the region know this history. And when you go out to the region and talk about it, they talk about sort of the negative effects of this history. It's useful to know why the history was formed, where the relationship comes from, and some of the consequences of it. I mean, my argument to this is political radicalism or Islamic radicalism in the region doesn't come from nothing. It doesn't come from just modernization and urbanization and globalization and all these things that we hear. That's all probably part of it. It also comes back to political decisions that were made. They were made in part by the United States, and they were made in part by our regional partners. When we were fighting the Soviets, we did not really care. We didn't want the Saudis to be promoting anti-Americanism, to be sure, but we didn't much care as long as that money was inoculating the next generation against godless communism. And what we're living with now are the legacies of that decision. And there's good and bad associated with that. The bad news is obviously what we're seeing. It's horrendous what's going on out in the region. And so give some insight into where it comes from. The silver lining, I would say, and it's very thin, but it's important to think about, is as the interests, our interests and our and those in the region, as they change, as it's clear how dangerous Islamic radicalism is, you do see country after country, Saudi Arabia being a prime example, no longer funding these groups. There are some wealthy Saudis who do, but the government doesn't do it nearly to the extent that it used to, and others don't as well because it's now a direct threat to them. So what's the result of that? Think about what we've just seen in Ethiopia and Somalia, right? The Ethiopians just came in with a well-funded or a military battle-hardened and crushed the Islamists in Somalia, and everybody attributed it to the fact that they were stronger and better trained. True. But what nobody talked about was the fact that Arab money, led by Gulf money, led by Saudi money, was not pouring into Somalia as it would have been in the, certainly the 80s, but even the 90s. That had that happened, had this battle happened 10 years ago, the outcome would have been very different. And so there's, in my mind, some of this Islamic radicalism, I believe it's very controversial, will slowly die its own death because it's not going to be getting that the same kind of funding it did. It's going to take more than a generation, and we have a lot of trouble ahead of us. But there is a trend, slowly, I think, to suggest that some of this will reverse itself And the most recent example is what happened in Somalia.
Let me. I want to get in here with a question and have you talk a little bit about the future of the Saudi royal family that governs the country now, because I think that there's a lot of speculation about just how much pressure and how serious this pressure is that the government faces from, on the one hand, liberal democratic reformers, and maybe a way to put that liberal in quotes, but democratic reformers on the one hand, and then very conservative Islamist militants on the other, ones who would be even more conservative than the current royal family would be, and that would be saying something. And there is a lot of speculation, and this is one of those myths that you address in that piece that I mentioned, that the regime is threatened and might, in fact, that there might be in somewhere in the near future now the potential that it would fall as a result of one or the other or combined various kinds of pressures on it.
Right. I think that's a great question, and it does often come up. Another reason that I wrote this book is that I think there is a sense that the House of Saud is fragile, it's going to collapse, and therefore you don't really have to plan. We don't need to plan for what our relations can or should look like with the Saudis, because the House of Saud isn't going to be around in 10 years. And that idea has, I think, been with us, even inside the government to some extent, for some time. And it has meant that we've never really done serious planning. Now, among sort of close Saudi watchers, I think there's a sense, that things could change tomorrow, absolutely. But if I had to sort of put my money, I don't think the House of Saud is collapsing anytime soon. Why is that? The liberal reformers are relatively weak. And also, this may surprise people, they also look to the current king, King Abdullah, as their leader and protector. King Abdullah is not viewed as corrupt as his half-brother King Fahd was, or some of the previous leaders. He's viewed as relatively pious. He was the first Saudi leader to walk out to the slums of Riyadh and say there's real poverty here, which, surprisingly enough, there very much is because of the way wealth is distributed. And he put Saudi Arabia into the WTO. He's gotten rid of some of the laws that institutionalize corruption, such as needing a domestic partner to invest. He's opened up investment laws. And so actually, for the liberal reformers, they're hoping that King Abdullah stays alive for as long, he's 83 years old, as long as he possibly can. So that leaves the other side of your spectrum, which is the Islamic radicalists, and they certainly were there, and that's sort of what the ideological mentors of bin Laden. To me, in my mind, those were the ones that were always the ones most likely to bring down the House of Saud. Since they overplayed their hand in 2003 and attacked the royal family through terrorist attacks in May of 2003, followed by November of 2003, followed by January of 2004, et cetera, the House of Saud has finally come together, and rather than co-opting them, as had been their traditional strategy, has gone after them and gone after them with a vengeance. They've rolled up cells, and there's lots of evidence to that, et cetera. Now, obviously, when you talk about counterterrorism, you never know what you don't know, so you don't want to be too confident about it. But if you look at, for instance, when they go in and raid a cell, the people in that safe house or wherever they're raiding have a lot of materials there. They're catching them red-handed, which means they're not getting advance warning, which means that the sort of infrastructure that used to be there is no longer there. So the fear in Saudi Arabia was that the Islamic extremists had penetrated the security forces and they turn around and overthrow the House of Saud. And I think since 2003, there's a greater sense that that is no longer the case. So on those two, I don't see the threats coming from either side of the continuum. The bigger question for Saudi Arabia is whether they're going to be able to deal with their bursting demographics. Population under 25 is higher than 50%. They've got a massive education problem. The issue of education has come up. They've got real problems. They're trying to address it. They're not really addressing it fast enough. So the question is whether they're going to absorb all of these people into the economy and to be functioning citizens. I would say that they are certainly making efforts, and that's why they have a lot of economic liberalization, but it's a wait and see, but probably not fast enough. But in the future, the challenge is going to be whether these groups somehow organize to put pressure on the House of Saud. Right now, and for the foreseeable future, I would say they are not organized. But when I was in Saudi Arabia in 1999, I had a meeting with he's now king, he was crown prince there, and he said at that time, unemployment is our number one national security problem. So he actually gets it. He understands the threat, and that's why I think he's moving so hard on economic reforms, is because he understands that unless they sort of figure out what to do with this youth, they themselves are in trouble.
Hmm.
So I don't see it falling anytime soon. I think we need to plan for them being around for a while. You never know what you don't know. But in terms of the different groups that you've laid out, they're not directly threatening, I would say, to the House of South.
All right. Let's take another caller in Savoy, nearby, line one. Hello.
Yeah, what do you think would be the effect of having the United States become independent in oil importation? I've seen some numbers, and I've done a little bit of figuring myself. We've worked in this area for quite a while. Maybe it would cost, oh, I don't know, probably $600 or $700 billion to go and build enough coal liquefaction plants to shut off outside imports. What do you think would be the effect of that on just the mere announcement of a plan like that on that cartel?
It's a very good question. I mean, if you're banking on coal, we're also going to have climate change.
No, I'll tell you what.
But aside from that, the question, I think...
Yeah, climate change is not an issue.
Right, if you pull yourself out of oil, so we're not dependent on oil, right, then a lot of things change, obviously. It's almost, if China didn't have if you didn't have Taiwan Straits and the importance of the communication routes there and transportation routes, you'd have a very different discussion around the importance of Taiwan and Taiwan and China. Without oil, you would have a very different discussion about the Middle East, to be sure. But I would suggest that because, going back to Mecca and Medina, is in Saudi Arabia, and because of physically where the Middle East is located, you know, the transportation routes of three major continents, it would still be of considerable importance. Would things change? Absolutely. But would we be able to ignore what goes on there? No, for that reason. And the second reason is because of the rest of the world is going to remain dependent on the export of oil. So even if we don't, the rest of the world is going to be. So I would just argue whether it happens or not, and I think it's unlikely, but it is very important to think very carefully about this part of the world because it's going to be a crisis region and with us for as far as we can see.
Hmm. We're coming to the point here. We have a minute or two left, maybe 2 minutes left. And I guess I just keep coming back to the idea that that publicly both governments, the Saudi government and the American government, has always talked about the fact that this is a very close, long and warm relationship. And it always struck me that this was never a love match. This was always a marriage of convenience. It entered into because that both parties saw benefits and not just the obvious ones that we talk about. Maybe we see that you have to appreciate the fact that there have been certainly ups and downs in this relationship and not just recently. But I think that what you have said, it's really important because here we always focus on whenever we talk about relationships between the United States and any other country, it's always through our lens. It's always, well, what does this mean to us? And that to get an appreciation for example, what the foreign policy of Saudi Arabia is, seems to me that's really important. And it's something that it's difficult to understand.
Well, I think that's right. I think it is very important. And you're right to point out that it is about shared interests. It very much is. Now, one of the challenges for this relationship moving forward, and it's a real challenge, is that this has always been a relationship elite to elite. There have been more Saudis in the United States, so the Saudi elite feels more comfortable in the United States often, or as comfortable as they do back in Saudi Arabia. It's a very, very American-leaning elite. The public is very much, the rest of the country is very much the opposite way. Saudi Arabia was the only country where 51%, so a majority of Saudis, said they actually didn't like Americans, not only American foreign policy, but Americans. This is a couple years ago. So the challenge for the leadership now, I think, is, well, there's many, but one of them that I try to focus on is this relationship cannot continue unless the public understand this relationship and what each side has gotten out of it. And especially in an age of mass media, you see the media flooding into Saudi Arabia. You know, they see the BBC, they see Fox News, they see CNN, they see news coverage from India. The Middle East sees a lot more global news than even we do because of physically where they sit. But unless the publics understand this, then it won't support itself on just the elite-to-elite relations. And so part of my hope on this book was that it was a book where Saudis and Americans at the table could sit down and debate it, that it wasn't so vitriolic that one side or the other wouldn't read it, but, you know, that it would become this sort of starting point where they could say, well, was this true? This is true. A place that you could start. Because unless we understand this relationship, and most of them, I would say, that America's relations with Saudi Arabia changed, but wasn't just that. Our whole set of allies and partners changed when the Cold War ended because they had all been built for certain reasons. And now we have to sort of think about which ones are important. And after September 11th, the Saudi one seemed, I think the Saudi one seemed really a negative because they weren't taking this problem seriously. And it wasn't until they started taking terrorism seriously that we could even begin to work together on certain issues. But still, I think the basis and the political interest and where we've overlapped and where we've differed, there's been a lot of differences, Israel-Palestine in particular, but a whole host of other how we approach Egypt, how different players, all of that. Unless we understand it, we're never going to get past the sort of sense it's all about oil and therefore it's either hopeless or we don't need to pay attention to it.
Well, that, I think, we'll have to wrap things up. With our thanks to our guest, Rachel Bronson. She is the Vice President for Programs and Studies at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, formerly known as the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. Before that, she was, in fact, Senior Fellow and Director of Middle East Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations in New York. And if you're interested, by the way, on the Chicago Council on Global Affairs, finding out what they're all about, they do indeed have a website. So if you have access, you can go there. And if you're interested in reading the book that we have talked about, the title is Thicker Than Oil, America's Uneasy Partnership with Saudi Arabia, published by the Oxford University Press. It was published last May by our guest, Rachel Bronson. And Dr. Bronson, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, thanks so much for having me.